Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Jerry White's my name. I work at Australian Council for Educational Work Research occasionally. It's my very great pleasure to introduce Stephen Downes to you this morning. I don't know how long I've known Stephen. I've got no idea, but I only met him in 2004, so work that one out. How many people here follow Old Daily, by the way? So there's a few in the room. Old Daily is a regular research commentary newsletter that goes out on a daily basis. And I'd have to say that probably I've learned everything I know from Old Daily. And that's largely from Stephen. Stephen's a bit of a contradiction in terms in many ways. He comes from a place that, I don't know, is that
Bunker? No, that's in the country.
Oh, it's here, is it?
Yeah.
Right, he lives in Canada, which is right up the top and very cold, and then you go right across to the eastern side to Brunswick, where the Irish settled, fishing place, and it's not a little bit cold, it's excessively cold. And we're walking down the road last night, where King's Way comes up at St Kilda Road, and Stephen said it's cold. It was like a seal looking at you and saying, is the ice cap melting? I couldn't believe it, Stephen. Stephen's been working in almost every single place that I can possibly think of in Canada. His list of places he's worked at, scale, the length and the breadth of Canada and so on, and various guises, architecture. It was the other little jobs, though, that I was absolutely fascinated by. He's been a pot washer, a 7-Eleven clerk, an education programmer, a newspaper carrier, waiter at a racetrack, hot dog vendor, building cleaner, camp counsellor. How on earth did you do those sort of things? There's an interesting question. I came across Stephen way back, it was about 98, something like that, when I moved into the National Agency here in Australia for ICT and so on. And he had a wonderful philosophy. And his philosophy was very simple, very easy, and that is that the whole business of education is about learning and building knowledge. And it's all he's focused on in the whole time that I've followed his work and all of his writing. He's written quite a lot of stuff. And he does that from the point of view of being open. Now, being open is not simple. To start with, it can be quite revealing in the sense that you feel quite vulnerable. Stephen's happened to manage to do that, and if I had to ask who has led, call it what you like, digital learning, digital literacy, e-learning, all the names it goes for, who's led that in the world in the last decade, it would be Stephen Downes. Brilliant philosophy, drives it selflessly, and there have been many times when I've seen Stephen under the pump, when he's been severely criticised for what he's done, but having said that, most of the things that he's argued have nearly always come out to be the original proposition he's put because it's been very carefully thought through to start with. One such case, of course, is the case of Blackboard, who took out a patent in Texas to simply say that they own all of the online education and training in the world. They own it. You pay them a license fee. Because basically it was worldwide fraud. And that was rumbled by Stephen. And I think the latest case at the moment is pending. It took on a Canadian company, Desire to Learn, simply saying that everybody that does any online learning is copying Blackboard. That's been pulled back and scaled back these days, which is wonderful. So those sorts of things that have happened in the online world, both on the research side, such as Blackboard and the fraud that they tried to perpetrate, right through to the deep research, and we're hearing about learning too, but there is a lot more that comes from Stephen Downes, and I would say that he is the one of the most preeminent researchers in e-learning in the world, certainly the most followed. I know everywhere I go in the world, people have followed his Old Daily and talked about the information that's on there and followed that through. Stephen, it's a great pleasure to have you here in Melbourne. He had no intention of coming to Melbourne, by the way. He was up in Sydney. So we coerced him down here, and it's a great pleasure to have you here. Ladies and gentlemen, Stephen Downes.
Hi, everyone, and just for the record, there's no way I can live up to that introduction. So, but thanks, and also that covered half of the presentation, too. No, I'm just kidding. I've got a plan for the day. Here's my plan for the day. It's all very carefully scripted. You can see, like, 10:15 to 10:40, anyhow. So that's here, but I want to begin with this session today by saying that this is your session and not my session, and therefore, if you want to move off of this plan, pursue your own interests in some way, follow the discussion, whatever, that is fine with me. I'm not wedded to this plan. I have plans, but the plans are simply to avoid the scenario of me standing up here with nothing to say. And that is why I make the plan. The plan isn't there so that I'm going to be telling you what to do for the next 3 hours. That said, I do have lots of stuff that I can cover. I've got some activities. The activities will be rushed because we only have 3 hours. It's the weirdest thing, right? We have 3 hours, but we only have 3 hours. It's that sort of balance. And I know that you're all familiar with this, so I'm not telling you anything you don't know. So basically, overall, the plan is to first look at how we do learn online, how you learn online, how I learn online. Secondly, to look a bit about, I don't want to say online community so much, although I know that's exactly what it says there, but I want to talk about the mechanics of learning in a network environment. We're going to have our break. Now, see, my plan is already broken because I had my break written down for 11:30, but I saw on the screen out there it's 11 o'clock, so it'll be somewhere in there. Talk about designing on online learning, and in particular, I want to look at the connectivism course that George Siemens and I did last fall, because that course was a practical implementation of the principles that we're talking about, and then some fun near the end. Hopefully it'll be fun near the end. As I say, I have assignments set up, so the very first thing I'm going to do is give everybody a number. So, oh, and we're recording. So hello to all the people who are listening online, either later today or 100 years in the future. That's kind of cool. So just so you know, we are recording so that there is evidence that's being left behind. So don't say things you'll regret 20 years later. And those of you recording, I'm just going to go around now and give people numbers so you can skip ahead about 30 seconds. So it's interesting talking to two separate audiences. Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Everyone got a number? Do you want a number? Here, 4. Okay, well, that was fun. How are you liking it so far? Yeah. Okay, so just remember those numbers, write it down. It'll come up a bit later. Where I want to start now is with the question, how we learn. And what I'd like you to do is to think for a moment, reflect for a moment on how you learn today. Now, I don't mean like right this very instant, because how you learn right this very instant is you're sitting at a table listening to me. That's not what I mean. In general, in your job, how do you learn new policies and procedures right now? What do you do, or what is done to you? How do you learn to use new technologies? And how do you learn to keep up with events, announcements, etc.? What is learning for you right now in your job? Just think about that for a couple moments. Now, I had another microphone. They were going to give me a wireless microphone. Because, you see, we have people listening on the tape, and so I want them to be able to hear you. Actually, it's not tape, it's digital recording. Okay, first of all, policies and procedures. I feel like Bill Donahue, and I've just dated myself everywhere. Is this on?
Hello?
No. Little thing in the bottom. Fine.
Pass.
Well, we'll pretend that this works. Okay. Who would like to... Oh, here comes the technician person who will give us batteries.
Hang on, just say it should be.
Oh, yeah.
No, that's okay. Just takes it. Sometimes it takes 30 seconds.
It just takes time to warm up. Okay, policies and procedures. And I'll give you this mic so I'm not holding a mic at you.
Okay.
How do you learn policies and procedures where you work?
Generally, they're put out on email or given a hard copy in our pigeonhole. I think we're expected to read it, understand it, and learn it.
Okay, email or a hard copy in your pigeonhole. People at random, but you can indicate if you are willing to speak into the microphone, and I'm still going to pick people up. How about you?
I'm just giving them a lot of stuff to read, and I read it.
A lot of stuff to read here, okay.
I learn by doing, so when somebody shows me a new procedure, I actually have to do it once or twice, and then when they stop telling me about it, I have to do it again by myself.
How about new technologies? How someone from this table, how do you learn new technology?
The best way is to learn by playing, I think, but it's a matter of making that time to play and to have a purpose for what we want to do. It doesn't have to be a complete purpose, but something that, you know, is that's in, within a classroom setting that's, you know, that I find worthwhile doing.
And is that what you actually do?
I do now, yeah. I've just been given the role as an e-learning facilitator, and I have got more time than I have in the past as a teacher, and I think in schools that often is, you know, difficult to do. So, and I know as part of my role I need to do that. I have a technology background anyway, but it's still always new learning for me.
Okay. How about your sort of thing? How do you learn new technologies?
Generally, it's tracking down what the new technologies are. I learn the very basics of it, and then I show it to a group of children and say, this is what I've found, this is what I've found to do so far.
Right.
Let's see what we can do, because I find 99% of the time, they'll find more things than what I can.
Sure.
But generally, the basic structure is, what are the toolbars, how do I get back from what the mistake I made, how do I find the things that can be developed within that program.
Now, and events and announcements, Greg, how do you keep up with events and announcements?
It's normally just through the email system. All of their policies come through there on a daily basis.
So you get notified of just on a regular basis through the email. And someone down here, how about, how do you get about, how do you keep up with events and announcements and things like that?
Also, just by reading email daily,
right.
Quite a lot of times daily, to keep up with what's happening. Because we are told everything that's being published that we need to know about is on our email, so we are forced to read our email.
Okay. And because I love your computer cover, you should show this to everyone. This is what computers should look like. Isn't that fun? Weren't expecting that.
It reflects my sense of humor, I think. I guess email, RSS feeds, all that sort of thing. And it's information overload.
Okay. So, your person who just came in, number 5. And he came in recently, too, right? Number 6.
member of the VBAC. Okay, well, that's pretty interesting, and frankly, I'm not surprised by that at all. And so here we have your, most of you are educators, right? How many of you are educators in one way or another? Business designers, things like that? Right. None of you, not one, I asked a bunch of people. None of you said courses. None of you said programs or anything like that. So I think it's very clear right from the very beginning that there's a distinction that can be drawn between the way you learn in your own work and the way learning is taking place in colleges and universities. Oops. Sorry, it's going to be annoying on me. Yeah, sure, the one that I need isn't there. This computer has been very slow today. I think adding 1,000 pictures or so to the hard drive haven't been good for it. What I want to talk about for a little bit is the whole idea of personal professional development. And this is something that you're already doing. And what I want to do is highlight this process to think about the processes, the mechanisms, the technologies, and indeed the personal pedagogies that you use in your own professional development. Now, this is not talking about how to teach other people. This is talking about you and how you teach yourselves. That's what my focus is here today, and that's what I want you to be thinking about, especially at this part of the seminar. And I've organized this into three basic principles: interaction, usability, and relevance. And we saw elements of all three of those in the methods, the processes that you described just at the start of this session. For each of those three, we can actually look into it a bit more deeply. And what I'll do in this first part of the presentation is look at what each of these things are, look at why we want it, and talk and focus most especially on how we can get these things, how we can get interactivity, how we can get usability, how we can get relevance. Just as an aside, you should feel free at any time to stop me, ask questions, etc. I just want to make sure that you all feel happy about that and comfortable in doing that. Because if you don't, I'll just keep talking. Now, I want to be clear that when I'm dividing the subject in this way, I'm not ordering the world the way it truly is with capital letters or anything like that. This is a device. This is just a way of me dividing up the field just to have a way of talking about it. The reality of learning personal professional development is messy and complex, like everything else in the world. So this is just a perspective on it, a point of view on it. I could describe personal professional development as, you know, red, green, blue. Red, emergency learning, green, forward thinking, blue, deep thinking, whatever. You know what I mean? I can divide it in any number of ways. The dividing isn't the important thing here. So interaction. Interaction, more or less, very loosely defined, is participation in a community, participation in a network, communications with other people. This diagram here is the paradigm learning 2.0 diagram of interaction. And it was created by Scott Wilson, and that's you at the center, and then those are all the different things that you are interacting with online. Other people's blogs, your blogs, Flickr photographs, to-do lists, live journal blogs, and learning materials offered by colleges, universities, governments, corporations, or whatever. And the idea here is that communications flowing back and forth through that. Now, why would you want something like that? Well,
again, you know, I could, it's messy and it's complex, but we can draw out from that messiness and complexity two major things. Human contact, just the idea that there's a human being at the other end of the wire, just the idea that you are belonging to a community, you have a shared practice, you have a shared vocabulary, there is an affinity there. And then human content, the idea that when you don't know things, other people will know the things you want. One of the things that we did when we were developing learning communities in Northern Alberta is we actually went out and asked town managers and elected officials how they discovered or how they learned the things that they needed to know in order to run these small towns. And what they said, most of all, is they picked up the phone and they called a friend. That's how they learned. Now, what's really important, at least to me it seems to be really important, is that you really cannot depend on traditional learning for interactivity. And even like, look at this session here. How much interactivity is happening here? Mostly, you know, we had a little bit at the start, but to a large degree, it's me talking, you listening. And a lot of traditional learning is like that. Most learning is based on the broadcast model. Most broadcasting is based on the broadcast model. Most interactivity is almost something separated from the learning that we're actually doing. What you need to do is, instead of relying on traditional learning, and indeed what you actually do in your own profession, is to build your own interactivity network. Those of you who learn about technologies, events, policies, etc., by email or notices, are participating in this way. You are at the center of some kind of communications network. There you are. And you are being connected to other elements, other people, offices, etc., by some or another communication system. In the past, it used to be telephone and the post, etc. Today, it's email, instant messages, phone calls, and the rest. What you're doing is creating, or what you want to do, is create your own personal network. And the idea here is that you can employ a wide range of different technologies in order to create this network. Now, let me frame this. I'm not saying you should use all of these technologies. What I'm saying is you should pick and choose from among these technologies in such a way that you use the technologies that are most comfortable to you, most familiar to you. You know, and there's, just as an aside, there's this aspect of technology which is like technology evangelism and the like, and people come up with a new technology or whatever, Twitter or Second Life or blogs or, you know, I remember when emails, you got to get emails, fantastic. And it's not about that, it's about finding something that works for you and settling into that niche where you're comfortable. Discussion list, email list, and mailing list, hundreds, thousands, millions of people still use those. They're very comfortable with them. It's, you know, the standard for corporate communication, and that's where they get their information. For other people, and I'm among them, web blogging is another way of creating the personal network. You create your own web blog, you read the web blogs of other people. This is one of my web blogs here. One that I have found very useful is instant messaging or Skype or Twitter or whatever. For me, instant messaging, it wasn't so much a work tool. It was the way that I kept in touch with my wife. And indeed, my wife is in Canada right now. And when I'm on the road, I send instant messages to her all the time. More recently, as technology and bandwidth have improved, I've started using Skype. So this morning upstairs, there I was having a free online video conversation with my wife who's living in Canada. And she kept me informed about all the events that are happening where I live. And since it's a small town in eastern Canada, not much. Snow's melting, that's about it. That's not true. The World Curling Championships are on in Moncton right now. I know you're interested in that. Online forums. These are becoming huge and hugely popular, especially since they emulate in so many ways a typical interaction, like this sort of interaction. Illuminate is a popular one. Centra, Adobe Connect, which isn't one of my favorites, but is still widely used. Any of these sorts of things can be used. And there are all kinds of events, in our field especially, there are all kinds of online events that take place. CIDR is a series of research symposia hosted by Athabasca University. They use Illuminate. The networking conferences here in Australia have used these tools. I forget what I think they used Illuminate, but I'm not sure. It was, yeah. EdTech Talk, that's Dave Cormier from Prince Edward, Rhode Island, and Jeff Lebo from the United States. They use a variety of technologies to set up online seminars. They've got something going like four or five nights a week. For you guys, that'd be four or five mornings a week. And they use Skype, they use Shoutcast, which is a live streaming media server, and a variety of other technologies. So you can find events almost every day, almost any time, even like on Australian time, you can still find huge numbers of these online events. In general, in interaction, pull is better than push. And what I mean by that is when you are interacting, it's better for you to choose the sources of your interaction than to select who you want to listen to pick what channels you're going to subscribe to or what you're going to follow, to look at the schedule and choose from that schedule what sessions you want to attend, rather than having this pushed towards you, because you are more likely to know what you are interested in and what will be more relevant to you than anyone who might organize these interactions for you. Interacting is about personal communication. It's about speaking with your own genuine voice. It's about having a perspective or a point of view and representing that perspective and point of view. You know, when we talk more about networks later on, what's really important is that knowledge is created from the combining or the joining of these different perspectives in order to form a whole. And the other thing is making a habit, making it a priority. It was in Sydney just the other day I came up with this, and I thought it was such a neat line that I think somebody's probably out there trademarking it now. Interaction is like breathing for the brain. And it's that's genuinely the case. You don't sit down and you say, well, I don't have time to breathe. It's just not a priority in my life. It's something you have to do. And interactivity, particularly for learners, particularly for people who are professionals, that's something that they have to do. If interaction isn't provided, you have to make it. A session like this, really what you should be doing, what you ought to be doing, is in some way creating interaction for yourself, working with the material, sending Twitter back channel messages to each other. How many of you are online right now? A few. Three, four. In the ideal Learning 2.0 world, you would all be online. In the ideal Learning 2.0 world, and in many of my talks, and it just wasn't practical for this one, I have another screen set up where the messages from the audience are displayed for everybody. Try to go fast and I slow right down. Here we go. I give people access to this screen and they type in a message and they submit the message. And then I use this screen. Ah, for crying out loud, I hate when it does that. See, it highlights the whole thing. That bad usability. Shouldn't highlight unless I ask it to. And so, and this is a remark from the previous session. People see it like this, and this will just go on its own. And now we're going to see messages wrapping up from the session I did in Austin a while back. Being online with your mobile phone. Just be online with your mobile phone. I see we've got spammers. Never mind then. I don't know what's going to be next. The idea here is that in sessions like this, you should be making interaction some way or another. If your software doesn't support interaction, if you're using something like, well, a learning management system or some such system, there are ways of embedding little comment boxes or chat rooms, etc. Turn your static course content into something that has interaction built right into it. The idea here is that you're creating a network, that you are a node in this network and you're communicating with other people in this network, and it's a four-step process that, you know, I'm abbreviating very badly here, but in general, what you want to be doing is aggregating, bringing content in, but not just bringing content in. You want to be remixing it, joining content from different sources, repurposing it, translating it to your own language, translating it to your own way of seeing the world, reforming it, and then feeding it forward, sharing it with other people, distributing the content again. And in that way, you create a network where each person is doing these four things. And you create this community of interactivity. Second major aspect of personal learning is usability. And usability, very simply defined, very, very, very simply defined, is simplicity and consistency. And we all know about usability because we depend on it every day. The sites that we use, like Google and Yahoo, are created by masters of usability. There are two major elements in my mind of usability: consistency, I know what to expect next time, and simplicity, I can understand how it works. I don't need lessons, I don't need a manual. Nobody needs really a manual to learn how to use Google. It's a very simple process. You type in what you're looking for, you press search, you find it. That's how you use Google. Now, I know I'm simplifying something that can be more complex, but the idea here is that you can access it, you can begin to use it without having to go through a long and involved process. As a learner, you need to take charge of simplicity, of consistency, of usability in your own learning. First thing that you want to do is clarify to yourself, and keeping in mind that you're not describing the nature of the universe, you're just organizing, clarify for yourself what you think you know. What are the foundational elements of your own knowledge? For people who are religious, that's articulating their faith. For people who are scientific, that's articulating for themselves what they think scientific method is, their method of inquiry, what counts as evidence, what counts as proof. Then organize that knowledge, and actually organize that knowledge. You can build your own content management system. My newsletter began simply from me doing a very simple type of organizing, where every time I read something, I wrote a little link, a little description, and I saved it into a database. And then I just made the contents of that database available. Simplify what you know. And again, you're not changing the nature of reality. You're just simply making it more accessible for yourself. You're working with your own knowledge. Well, one of the things that I do is summarize, summarize, and summarize. Doing my links, doing my posts in 100 word or maybe 200 word chunks is a bit of an art form, but what I'm doing is forcing myself to by eliminating those elements that are not directly relevant to my need, finding the abstract, finding the essence of these resources that I'm looking at. Now, my essence will differ from your essence. That's why you shouldn't just read my summaries. You should create your own summaries. Use your own vocabulary. Use your language, because everybody uses a slightly different language. This idea that we have a common language, not really. Everybody has their own language. Every community has elements of its own language, has elements of its own jargon, its own standards for proof, its own standards of evidence. Simplify, again, don't compartmentalize, but try to make, what I mean by that is, don't over-categorize, don't slice and dice to the point of extreme complexity. There are two aspects of usability. One aspect is social. Can you search through your own learning? Can you search through other people's learning? Do you use the same language or different language to represent things? In the world of metadata, they talk about things like crosswalking. In the world of language, they talk about things like translating. The idea here is that your knowledge, your learning, interacts or connects with other people's knowledge or other people's learning. And then usability is personal. What's simple is what is simple to you. There isn't some sort of absolute standard of simplicity. What is consistent is consistent to you. Usability also requires guerrilla tactics. Your institutional CMS is probably dysfunctional. If it's like ours, it certainly is dysfunctional. You should be organizing and creating your own management system, and ideally a distributed management system. Put your photos on Flickr, your videos on YouTube, your documents on Google Docs, or whatever is comfortable for you. Create a blogger or a blog on Blogger just to take notes. People are taking notes here. The idea is that you take notes on a simple interface, a consistent and easy to use interface like Blogger. Store your photos on Flickr, as I said, etc. The idea here is that you're creating a network, and you're, how do I want to phrase this? The idea here is that you are engaging in activities that will simplify and abstract the information that's in front of you. You're presented with, as we said in the opening discussions, this overwhelming flow of information. Information overload, email overload. And the idea here is that you're taking this, and instead of it being this great big thing, you're drawing from that only what you need, and you're reforming it so that it's useful specifically to you. Finally, the third part is relevance, sometimes known as salience. This is the idea of learning that is important to you now. And the idea here is people getting what they want, when they want. And there's two aspects to relevance, the content and location, having it where you want it, when you want it. First of all, the first step is to maximize your sources. How many of you read blogs right now? I'm just curious. Less than half. How many of you use RSS readers? Same people. Okay, for those of you who don't, you want to try this. And again, if we had internet sufficient for everyone, I would have everyone do this at this point in time. I can't do that because we just don't have the bandwidth here and the computers here. But when you go back home or back to your office, go to this website, google.com/reader, and set up an account in Google Reader. Now, inside Google Reader, you are able to search for topics. And let me just... I hate when it does that.
Here's mine. Yeah. Okay. So Google Reader will make recommendations for you, and once you start following things, Google Reader will make better recommendations for you. Now, here's a simple trick for using Google Reader. Remember earlier I said create a blog to take notes about things, right? Now, if you're doing that, if you are recording things like your notes from this session or your notes on some readings that you've done or whatever, you know, public stuff, not company secrets, in your blog, I love lolcats. Well, yeah, this one has one. We'll have a little, you see at the top there, that little orange box? If you click on that, what that'll show you is the RSS feed for that blog. And an RSS feed is very simply a bunch of XML. Isn't that pretty? Now, there are ways to write XML, but you don't need to worry about that. All you need to know about that is it's a simple text representation of the content of your blog. So what you do, click on this little thing, and typically if you're in Firefox or Internet Explorer, you'll have the opportunity to subscribe, and you can choose your application, BlogLines or My Yahoo or Google. I typically use Google. I have used the others. And then you just hit subscribe and add to Google Reader, and now unsubscribe to this lolcat feed. And what that means is every time somebody produces a new item in that feed, that's going to show up here in my reader. So here I am in my reader. So now here's the secret. Go to your own blog. Your own blog. And for that matter, your own Flickr channel. Your own YouTube channel. Wherever you've stored stuff. Oops. Oh no, it's not. So here's me. I have the Twitter search for me. This is, by the way, for those of you who are wondering, how do I keep up with Twitter comments about me without subscribing to individuals? I just use a Twitter search. Very simple. So this is the stuff that people are saying about me on Twitter. What are they saying about me on Twitter? I haven't looked at this yet. Oh, there's other Downses too. There's a Sean Downs. Let me see what else we got here. How hard it can be. Connections. Oh, okay. Oh, somebody. There you go. Right. See, so I can find out what people are saying about me. So here's the Technorati tag. But the thing is, right, what I'm doing is I'm subscribing to stuff about me or stuff that I've created. Here's my own newsletter, OL Daily. So I publish this particular post on Friday. Now, when I do this, if I go back to the Google homepage, Google will suggest stuff to me that is similar to stuff I already subscribed to. If the stuff I subscribe to is my own stuff, Google is going to start recommending to me stuff that is similar to my own stuff. And it never ends. It will keep on suggesting stuff. And as you pick stuff to subscribe to, so let's view the recommendations here. Canadian trademark blog, that reflects my interest in trademark and copyright. Virtual philosopher, that one's pretty obvious, right? So I go through these, I look at them, I pick the ones that I want, I ignore the ones I don't want, and presto changeo, I've got a set of feeds here that, you know, it's hundreds of feeds from different sources, but it's all on one single place, all on one single web page. And so I am plugged in. I am getting the information that I want when and where I want it. I don't have my BlackBerry with me, but I can get my feeds on my BlackBerry. I can get my Twitter search results on my BlackBerry.
email on my BlackBerry. So I have all of this information, all of this stuff, every day, every minute, when and where I want it. Now, again, this will come up later. You don't want to spend every day, every minute reading your feeds, right? But the idea here is now you have no shortage of information. Now you can begin to organize and filter that material. And that's the next step here. Once you've got all the resources you could possibly want, and anyone can do this, then the next step, step two, filter ruthlessly. Really, really, really ruthlessly. I read maybe 1 in 20 items that shows up in my RSS reader, right? I'll read the headlines and the quick summary, but I'll actually follow up only a small percentage. I'll actually write about an even smaller percentage. I'll read several hundred items in a day because it's very quick and easy for me to do this. And I just, you know, when I have a few minutes, I do some grazing, right? But I'll actually write about only a few of these things. What's very important is that you do this picking and choosing, that you are the one that filters information for yourself, because you are the one that knows best what you like, what you're interested in. Really, now I know we're in a formal session and all of that. In general, not the present case, of course, it's better to shun formal classes and sessions in favor of these informal activities. And part of when I talk about the connectivism course, what you'll see is that the course itself represents a transition from something that is formal to something that looks more like this Google Reader approach to learning. Now again, you need to be, or can be, perhaps should be, a little bit subversive about this. My work environment is probably a lot like your work environment. It's like, you know, cinder block walls in institutional gray. I arrive there way too early, and I'm still sleepy. And I leave there way too late, and I'm still sleepy. And you know what I mean. Your learning takes place when it takes place. And I think this is true especially for professionals or anyone who's involved in an idea-based or thought-based discipline. Your learning takes place where it takes place. And you need to balance that. And sometimes balancing that means, as it says there, taking a nap at the office. I certainly encourage it. Now, I know, some of you can't, but you know what I mean. The idea here is that, you know, like people like to tell you, when you're at work, you must be doing nothing but working. That would be fair if and only if, when you're not at work, you are not thinking about work at all, much less doing any work. You know what I mean? So we want to balance this. So if your work flows into your home, and for most of us it does, then it's perfectly fair for our home to flow into our work. The idea here, this way of approaching learning, and again, you know, I subscribe to almost 1,000 feeds. I've got hundreds of stuff coming in every day. The idea, and there's no way I'm going to assimilate all of that and internalize all of that. I don't want to. It's like trying to drink a river. It makes no sense. You want to think of this information, this form of learning, as a flow, rather than as a collection of static objects. If it's important, it'll come back. And it does. These things cycle around. So you don't need to worry about missing stuff. Relevance to you is determined by what it helps you do, what you do with it, and what it helps to do. Information isn't important just because it's about e-learning. You look at my feeds, you know, my specialization is in e-learning. My feeds run everywhere from philosophy to, well, lolcats now, I have various other cartoon sites, to science, to neurophysiology, to media, and, you know, because those are the sorts of things I can use in my discipline. So it's what I can use, not what it's about. You need to develop these unofficial channels of information, not just the RSS reader, but contacts and email, people who will send you stuff, any sort of channel of information where you're getting material that's relevant to you. And part of what you have to do in order to manage that is to disregard many of the official channels. In general, people are beginning to disregard things like television. People in the workplace ought to be focusing at least as much on these informal channels as on, say, management directives and the like. I scan and then I delete most of the institutional email that comes into my mailbox, because the institutional email represents somebody else's priorities as to what's important. If it's really important, it'll come back. You should, again, organize these communications. Create a project page on your wiki. Link directly to forms or whatever that's important to you. If you work in a large organization, you're probably working with things like shared file directories and things like that. And if you work with those, you know that they're a pain, they're miserable to navigate. You're always having to remember where things are. Create your own separate page and link to them, so that if you need Form 22A, you go to your wiki page, you click on Form 22A, it pops up in your Microsoft Word. Things like that. Demand access. That's an issue. It's very much an issue here in Australia. It's not only an issue here in Australia, it's an issue in Canada. And I don't understand how people allow IT departments to tell them what you can and cannot see. And I know what happens. I send my newsletter out, and every once in a while when I use the wrong word, like my newsletter is rejected by like all of Queensland. And it's the funniest thing. And the words are completely innocuous. It's very important to root around this sort of thing, because again, the blocking of content is somebody else deciding for you what is important and relevant to your own learning. And you know, I think you already know that the person who's most responsible for your own learning is yourself. Root around blocking. That's the original iPod. These mobile internet devices are really going to change the work environment, the educational environment, where the idea of YouTube being blocked, SlideShare being blocked, Facebook being blocked, they may be blocked on the official corporate system, but people will be carrying internet access in their pocket. And it works now, it works here now. It's not as fast as I'd like, but it works. I'm going to skip that slide because I'm coming back to that. Now, what I'm really saying with this part of the talk is, first of all, in your own personal professional development, you were at the center of your own personal learning network. And to gain from this self-directed learning, you have to be self-directed. You and nobody else is responsible for your own learning. And that's true, right? In your own workplace now? I'm looking for nods. Right. And third, these principles ought to inform how we teach as well as how we learn. And that's what connectivism is all about. That's what learning too is all about, is enabling and setting up structures to support learning, where learning for people, even people in colleges, universities, schools, is more like the model of personal professional development that I've just outlined. Now,
Stephen, are there some things out of control though? As professionals, we get asked to do lots of things in terms of learning new programs, new software, and so on. We might be that interested intrinsically, but we have to do it anyway, so it's not really in our control.
there's always, well, I mean, everything is within your control. Right? So let's reframe that right off the bat. Right? Everything is within your control. You have the capacity to choose not to take that training. Now, there will be certain repercussions, but it's not like a law of nature is forcing you to do that. It's not like if I step off the stage, I'm going down. That's out of my control, right? So it becomes now a question of negotiating that environment in which you're working. And I think the first step to negotiating that environment in which you're working is to accept that, no, these things are not out of your control, that you do have a responsibility for the actions that you take if you are going to some sort of training program because it was mandated by management. You have made that choice. And what you are doing, in fact, is conducting in your own mind an exchange of some sort. For example, continued employment, go to the course, right? But if you represent it that way, I think that that changes your attitude toward that course. And then what happens is you go to the course because you're doing it in exchange for continued employment. But you should feel empowered at that point to take that course and say, I'm going to convert that into a learning experience that is useful to me, as opposed to simply something that I've been told to do. Right? My conduct, my activities in that course are within my own control as well. One thing that you can do, which you've just did, is you sit back in the back of the room and somebody says something in this mandated course and you can raise a question about that. Is this true? You know, I mean, right off the bat, the very first thing people should be doing in these mandated courses is saying, is this true? That's the first thing you guys should be doing to this talk, is saying, is this true? And then secondly, the activities that I've been talking about, the interaction during the course, the working with the material, the reorganization of the material, the translation of the course into your own vocabulary, the framing of it, the being able to access that material later, all of these things you should be doing to take that course and changing it from organizational learning to personal learning. And so, you know, but it begins. The first step is to understand that, you know, it's not something beyond your control. And, you know,
Well, we might agree to differ on that, because if organisations say we want you to do SharePoint, we want you to go to Vista or whatever, you know, it's very hard to sort of say every time, well, I think I'll change jobs.
No, and I'm not saying you're going to change jobs every time the organisation sends you to training on Vista or SharePoint or whatever. What I'm saying is you convert that organizational learning into personal learning if you decide to take that learning, right? If you decide to take that learning, and in most cases you will because you want to keep being employed, then you convert that learning into something that's useful to you. You know, it's like it's this passivity that just kills me. This passive, oh, I've got organizational learning, I'm just going to sit back and take it. You know, like, the idea here is that you don't simply sit back and take it. You actually reach out, you engage it. You know, and this is your responsibility as a learner. This is something that the instructor can't do. Like, here I am sitting here, standing here. I cannot possibly create that engagement. That's something that you have to do. You have to reach out and engage in the material and do whatever it is you want with the material. Does that make sense? Any other comments? Because this is like the end of part one of four, and I'm probably already behind time. Go ahead.
Well, it does sort of make sense, but it also, at some level, doesn't, in that I have a strong engagement with you, and I am engaged in what you're saying, and I've got lots of comments to make. But all the people here actually came here to listen to you because you thought about these issues for a lot longer.
Yeah.
And they actually want, and I want, to see the structure that you've imparted on a whole area. So there's something formal about the way you're presenting things that is not to be in opposition to the informal stuff, the informal way of learning. And there's almost a false dichotomy. There's a straw man here somewhere. And when you talk about formal learning, you're sort of talking about teaching, and then you're still taking a step back as to what's imposed on us when we teach people.
Okay.
But the organisational issues, I have actually moved jobs a couple of times because I'm not like, I've been quite active. Now, I'm currently employed somewhere where I've chosen to be entirely passive about the constraints placed by the IT area, because I actually do want to feed my family. Now, that doesn't mean I turn my brain off, and it doesn't mean that I don't do things, but we do actually have to sometimes feed our families. So they are real issues, and they don't mean that we're choosing to be passive intellectually. So I think there's a difference between being passive in terms of maintaining peace in the organisation, so to speak, and working within those constraints versus being passive intellectually. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes total sense. I mean, the idea here is that there are multiple simultaneous constraints on what you're doing, and learning is just one of those. Eating is another one, equally important, possibly even more important. And so at any given time, when you're making choices, including choices about learning, you're, I don't want to say balancing because that's the wrong picture, but you're taking into account all of these different constraints. And the heart of my message, if I have a single message, the heart of my message is something along the lines of, these are decisions that you are making, rather than decisions that are being made for you, or ought to be decisions that you are making, rather than decisions that are being made for you. Now, that does not mean that you can't let somebody else drive the bus, right? From time to time, for example, in this seminar, you'll let somebody else organize and present the material, presumably because, like, for example, they'll know the route better, or they're professional drivers, or whatever. That's perfectly appropriate. But at any time, the key is to keep in mind that you are making the choice, even as you sit there, whether or not to continue sitting there or to walk out of the room. And that is a conscious choice that you're making. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's kind of what I want to say. Go ahead.
But often when the sort of organisation as a whole makes a decision, you don't just have to sit back and accept it. My school blocked YouTube and Facebook, and a group of us disagreed, and we had some discussions, and we got the leadership team on side, and we did a bit of work with it, and at the end of term they decided that they would unblock it.
Right.
And that was very different from their view at the start of the year. But by being perhaps a bit more proactive and getting some discussion going, rather than sit there and say, they won't let us have YouTube,
right,
we got them to change their decision.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, again, it's the passivity versus the proactivity. And you know, people very often are willing to just accept things that they could, in fact, change. If, as you described, if they actually engaged, if they actually took action in order to change the situation. So, does anyone know what time it is right now?
10:10, we're finishing at 11:30, so you've got about 15 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
All right.
Terrific.
Well, goodie then. So, yeah, like, I'm running about half hour late. Which is okay. I make these plans for these seminars, and then these plans never work out, but it's still okay because I never expect the plan to actually work. Never mind, let's shut up now. Okay. I also had this neat system with multiple slides. Okay, and actually, here's what I want you to think about now. How you'll organize yourselves, how you'll organize your learning, how you'll organize your learning for other people. Now, I've given you a number. You each have a number. I hope everybody has a number. You now belong to six different groups. These groups, you are now part of these groups. These groups are distributed geographically. Not very far geographically, but nonetheless, you're all over the place. How are you going to organize yourselves, collaborate, communicate now while you're distributed? And for those of you who don't have internet access or iPhones or whatever, it's going to be very difficult, right? So, dead silence. All right, so you can all start shouting. I was expecting that.
Group one should be that table there.
Yeah, you're because the situation is where our groups actually aren't able to communicate because you don't all have communication devices and bandwidth, etc. You're going to have to meet physically. So, just after I do the next slide or so, reorganize yourselves so that you're sitting in your groups. Now, I think the groups are actually larger than the tables, so they might overlap a bit. But something like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And, sorry. What I want you to do in your groups is each group has its own assignment. Now, you want to keep track of this because the text is small. Okay, so group one, I don't want to read it out word for word, but it's really small and it's hard for you to read. So, people who are close to the front in group one, two, and three, get that information down. And 4, 5, and 6, be ready because yours are coming up. I really tried to put it on a single slide. I also thought about 6 separate slides, and I didn't like that either. And in retrospect, I probably should have thought of... There's this technology that is actually very useful for situations like this. And I just didn't have it available. It's paper. Okay. Okay, here come 4, 5, and 6. And as you guys are writing these things down, now what I want you to do in your groups is not to actually solve these problems, because that's very much putting the cart before the horse. What I want you to do is come up with a plan as to how you're going to go about solving these problems. So how are you as a group going to communicate? How are you as a group going to interact? How are you going to set it up so that even if you're in distributed locations, you can still work on this design? So with that, why not break into your groups now? And we're sort of at the break time, so we'll break into our groups, have our break, and then we'll come back after the break. So that'll be about 15 or 20 minutes or so. And then we'll move on to the next part of the session. Does that sound okay? And I got a thumbs up at the back of the room. Okay. And on that note, audio people, we'll just pause this and get back together in a bit. Okay, just so you all know, now we've got coffee and snacks outside, and so we're beginning our break now. So feel free to continue on your discussion, but also feel free to start your break, and then once we've had the break, we'll come back together and talk a little bit about what the groups have done. So the break is starting now. Okay, well, we're back. And as you can see, the big recorder is back recording again. So once again, your words can and will incriminate you. And what I'd like to do is begin just by briefly summarizing, very briefly, because we don't have a whole lot of time. We have six groups. So, you know, 3 minutes per group means 18 minutes. We want to be, like, really brief, like not 3 minutes. So what I'll do is I'll pass the microphone from group to group, and we'll just find out how you did indeed decide to organize yourself. So how are you guys going to work together to solve these problems? We'll just go to group number one here.
Tad?
Yeah, that works. So who's our...
Oh, Tad.
There we go.
Right, you read ours. It was all about the simulation booking system of the airplane. And we come up with ideas like just getting a blog or a meme going so that they can talk about what they, who they are and what they know already about systems, about setting up, getting to evolve a criteria list for what makes a good booking system, hopefully involving some drama, and recording that using a tool like SlideShare. I really like your idea about the FAQ, that was funky. How's that?
Sure. Okay. Now, is this how you are going to work together as a group, or how the learners are going to work together?
We're
all
working
the same. Okay, I'll move on.
Our task was to develop an online, or to provide a literacy support program to children in Broome who have access to inexpensive laptops. We felt very clearly that a lot of time spent by us as the developers in Broome would be quite a sensible early strategy. But apart from that, our conversation was really a tumbling out of ideas, and perhaps the clearest and strongest one that came out of it was for us to become a community before we could establish how we could work with the community of learners in Broome. We talked at some length about the nature of the task, who had asked us, what expectations they may have had. There were various suggestions about software packages that might have been useful, but inevitably it became a matter of us working out how we would work together before we could actually decide to do anything.
Great, and that's actually what I was looking for, was how you would work together as a group before you tried to solve the problem for the other people, how it would communicate and organize yourselves.
Can I just say one thing? It was canvassed that we would also use the same technology that the learners would use. So we tried using the netbooks. One group member was like, no way. But we felt that we'd need to know what problems our learner community might have.
Yeah, that's an excellent insight, absolutely. What's the phrase, eating your own dog food? I really hate that phrase. That's a Canadian import, I guess. Okay, next group. This group's negotiating to see who'll speak.
Problem was to create an online learning environment in Malaysia through university, and we thought that as a group we should meet together online and sort out the problems that we might have doing that and use that experience to inform our solution for Malaysia.
Did you come up with a technology that you would use to meet online?
Well, we came up with Virtual Classroom as a technology, and we were slightly suspicious because we have a representative from the company in our group.
So that means it'd be free then?
Yes, free. We talked about the limitations of that and also the features and functions that would be useful to our training to and that we need a variety of solutions and a translator.
Thank you.
Okay, next group. This will be group 4, I think. And the spokesperson, they are negotiating. Do someone volunteer? Shall I pick someone?
Have you solved the problem that we expect? How you work?
Solve the problem rather than. So now, but you're needing to make a decision as a group, specifically who will represent yourselves.
No mechanism.
Can you adjust that? The way you asked, you what we thought was we use, we arrange technologies, we'd focus on existing communities, so we utilise what was already there, and even though not everyone uses a lawnmower, the issue with lawnmowers are causing accidents, we felt that we would also use a self, that people would self-filter and stuff coming through that you didn't need to know about, you delete it, basically, or you delete it from your phone or through an email. So we sort of talked more about the way we might solve the problem,
well,
tend to address the issue.
Let me ask, because this comes up quite a bit, why do you suppose your group solved the problem rather than the question of how you would organize and communicate among yourself? If you guys went straight to the problem.
It was the pass.
I didn't listen to what the task was terribly well. And so we came to the table. And then we didn't actually address the task of how we would communicate. It was more about how we would solve the problem of getting together something that would address the needs of students to create a multimedia product for some 2-year-off event in Sydney. That would then reflect positively on the politicians who gave the money in the first place. So we tended to explore a whole lot of different issues related to all of that, and hopefully amongst some of those issues were the notion that whatever we did, it should be the students that were driving the end product and how it was done. And I think it's fair to say we didn't talk too much about teachers as such, but it was more about the products that might accrue out of the project and the way that teachers could facilitate students to be able to create all of these different things, the multimedia project, products and so forth. So that's sort of where we ended up. And we ended up possibly without anything totally clear that we would be able to sell, other than suggesting that the students would ultimately come up with the answer for us. Which is possibly a bit of a copy out of where we are, or maybe it's enabling the students to be able to devise that, make it whatever they wish it to be.
Okay. Works for everyone there? Yeah, the unanimous support of your group.
Come on, you
like. And finally, group 5. We actually, a real volunteer.
Okay, our scenario was that an author has published a new book called The Art of Persuasion, and the target market is business professionals around the world setting up community spaces to share stories and setting up training and so on. I think the overriding response that our team had was that there is no one answer to this particular problem. And there were a range of things that came up. The first thing would be to develop that list of people who are interested, and from that, hopefully, it would snowball. So whether it starts with an email list, a contact list from the various different publishers, so on and so forth, setting up a space, irrelevant as to which sort of space it is, depending on who is going to be using it and which one they feel more comfortable. So whether it's a Facebook and then a wiki, we had LinkedIn and Plaxo and a few other, there are loads of them out there, or as Paul suggested, he's a web person, so he built his space. Looking at Twitter to develop and expand that community. We also talked about having a range of communication tech opportunities, like, as well as the written form, having the photos, having the podcasts and so on, and all of those online as well. And then we spent some time talking about how people would join that community and that it would then build from that.
Thanks. I kind of
expected this sort of, you know, a mixture, I'll say it like that, a mixture of responses varying from actually doing what was assigned through a fairly wide range of things that weren't really assigned to actually solving the problem at hand. Now, I think there's a lesson in that. There's a lesson in that for me, anyways. Everyone draws their own individual lessons. And, you know, because, you know, I do sessions like this quite a bit, and I'm sure all of you do too. And the words that actually come from the person speaking on the podium don't actually constitute the content of the learning material. And indeed, the words that actually come from the podium are heard very differently by each person that's sitting around. And you know, I gave you an assignment that looked like something, and as soon as you saw that, it was like, oh yeah, that's what I'm seeing now. And you actually heard something different from what I said. And I think that's true generally. Now, do you want the little short bit on knowledge, or do you want the video? One for the video? Oh, yeah, you get both, but which do you want first?
Stephen, could you show the video and email the other stuff?
And email the other stuff. Now, that's taking learning into your own hands. This is not my video, this is somebody else's video, but I quite like it. It should work. Oh, wait. I almost screeched you all again. Okay, first of all, let's stop the recording. So those of you who listen, who are listening on audio, we're just going over to the video, and the video is called Connectivism Presents, but I can't play the audio of the video onto the audio because we'll get horrible feedback. So, bye. Okay, what I was saying there, what's interesting about that video, it was a follow-up to the Connectivism course that George Siemens and I did last fall. We had nothing to do with the production of that video. It was done spontaneously. And it really captured, to my mind, a lot of the elements of Connectivism. I want to do two major things in the time that we have left. And that's not one of them. I want to talk very briefly. Right, of course, now number two isn't there. There we go. And I bet you three won't be there the next time. I want to talk very briefly about the theory behind this. And then after that, I'm going to spend more time. We'll actually look at the Connectivist course that George and I built and how it was built and the thinking. But I want to talk about the learning model first, because the way we designed the course, we didn't just slap a bunch of stuff together. We had a very specific set of principles that informed the design of the course. Now, George's version and my version differ somewhat, but there's an awful lot of overlap. And so I'm going to give you my version, which is, as I say, a bit different from George's, but nonetheless, the overlap was sufficient for us to work together on this course. So where we begin is with a definition of knowledge, and we say that to know something, to have knowledge, is to be organized in a certain way. And to be organized in a certain way also involves recognizing or being able to recognize. Now, it's kind of a hard concept, and I don't have a lot of time to linger on it. But what I mean by that is to know that, say, Paris is the capital of France, is to have a certain set of neural connections, is to have your brain organized in a certain way. But it's not just being organized in that way. It's also being organized such that some other person coming along can recognize that you are organized in that way and that knowledge is, quote, Paris is the capital of France. Does that make sense? I'll give you an example to try to draw this out. This is only a metaphor. It's not literal. If you think of your TV screen, has a picture of Richard Nixon on it. The way it has this picture of Richard Nixon on it is that the pixels that make up the screen are organized in a certain way. Having Richard Nixon on your screen just is to have your pixels organized a certain way. But the organization by itself is not enough. You, as the viewer, have to recognize that organization and see it as Richard Nixon. So we have two major aspects: the organization aspect and the recognition aspect, and they're equally important. This is best contrasted with an alternative theory of learning, which is probably the mainstream theory of learning. I would certainly think that. And that's the idea that knowledge consists of models that we build in our mind that represent reality, where these models are composed of propositional entities, or, if you will, sentences, words and sentences. And there are theorists out there, people like Fodor and Polishin and others, who literally think that we have sentences in the brain, and that is what our knowledge is. And indeed, for some of them, like Fodor, we have a built-in, innate vocabulary in the brain. Example, and it creates a very different type of knowledge. You have, on the one hand, knowledge as organization and recognition, and on the other hand, knowledge as declarative sentences. And the entities of knowledge are very different. Examples of declarative knowledge are, well, like statements, propositions, this is a duck, the sky is blue, general principles, fish swim, birds fly, causation, the recession was caused by, sentences that we normally think of as a sentence as a verbal entity that is supported by some sort of evidence. So we think evidence makes this sentence true, this sentence is true because of the evidence. Question?
So Paris is the capital of France is a declarative statement,
right?
Not a recognition.
That's right.
Felician goes on to talk about his work in visual perception.
Right.
Is not sentences linguistic, so perhaps
Your
pattern matching stuff is more
Well, Polishin, it's not linguistic, but it's nonetheless procedural, right? It's nonetheless formula. Well,
we could debate that, but it's more about whether you recognize by patterns, which the Polishin model of ontological recognition would be more pattern-based, and how you pull together those things.
I'm thinking it's, for example, Polishin's criticism of Koslin. Koslin has a mental picture, rotating a cube in the mind, right? Koslin is like you're actually rotating images. Polishin is saying, no, the reason why it takes longer when you're rotating an image is you're going through these processes or procedures. You're not actually rotating a mental image. Nonetheless, Polishin or not, there are people How's that?
And
photo is one of them. And to be perfectly fair, maybe Polishin has adjusted, modified, or adapted his view since I've last looked at him, because it has been a number of years. So that could well have happened. But we can talk about that after. And I would say also, and I don't want to use the word naive, but a common sense or folk understanding of what knowledge is that it's something like this, is that we have general principles, is that we think in sentences or words, representational entities of some sort. Connectivism is an alternative to that. It's not simply saying that knowledge is formed of connections, but it's also saying that the mechanics, the rules, I don't have a bad word, I don't want to say rules, the processes that create and generate knowledge are distinct from what would characterize the alternative cognitivist picture, where learning is not to acquire a set of facts. Learning is not to put this sentence in the brain, that sentence in the brain. Learning is not to create or construct some sort of model of reality in the brain, but rather learning is to develop or to grow into a certain configuration, to become rather than to acquire. Knowledge in this picture is not propositional, is not a series of declarative sentences. You can't even represent it that way. It is distributed, it is emergent, and it is ineffable. But again, these are hard concepts to get your mind around. But when I say, for example, it is distributed, if I say, for example, somebody knows that Paris is the capital of France, what I do not mean is that they have a sentence, Paris is the capital of France, and they don't even have something resembling Paris is the capital of France, but rather that knowledge really consists of a set of connections, your concept of Paris, your concept of capital, your concept of France, distributed over a wide network of connections in the brain. Now you might think, okay, that's really fuzzy and crazy, and how could that be true? So let me give you a more concrete example using a different network, a social network. Knowledge of how to fly a 747 from Paris to New York. Now, no single individual has that knowledge because it's very large and it's very complex, because you need to know a lot to fly a 747 from Paris to New York. You need to know how to make tires. You need to know how to make glass, to assemble aircraft parts. You need to know how to take off an airplane. You need to know how to navigate an airplane, serve coffee even when it's bumpy, all kinds of things. You need to know how to manage and set up an air traffic control system, weather prediction. All different people have all of these different bits of knowledge. You need to know how to land an aircraft without crashing the aircraft. You need to know what to do if you crash an aircraft. You see what I mean? That when I say knowing how to fly an aircraft from Paris to New York, there is no thing that is that knowledge. There is no entity in which that knowledge is contained. Rather, that knowledge can only be described very loosely, and it's distributed. This person has one bit, this person has another bit. The people distributed have this knowledge collectively. This knowledge is emergent. It's not contained in any one of them, but rather exists simply because of the states of and the connections between the individuals that collectively make up that knowledge. Does that kind of make sense? You're nodding.
No.
Or are you criticizing? No, I'm just kidding. I'm teasing.
The airline industry is the most proceduralized one in the whole world.
Well,
just as an aside, that's for later too.
That's funny.
No,
that's good, though.
I agree with most of what you're saying, but the two examples I'd say exactly the opposite ones.
That's hilarious. You know, you're absolutely right, though, when you said the airline industry is the most proceduralized in the world. But as an aside, I hadn't thought of that. It's proceduralized because
of the complexity.
Yeah, nobody can have the knowledge in their head. It's just too large, too complicated. So what I'm saying is knowledge in the mind is the same kind of thing. I'll have to think about that. Sounds good. So, what connectivist learning theory is, then, is the theory of how these connections form, how to grow connections in either the mind or in society, just how to grow connections generally. And I identify four mechanisms here. I'm not saying these are the definitive set. Again, declarative general principle type knowledge, not on, right? So I'm giving you an indication of sort of what these processes are. But don't go and say, well, Stephen said there are four methods of forming connections, right? There is just a way of categorizing this knowledge. So these four ways are, sorry, I couldn't resist, simple associationism. Two things fire off at the same time, two things are not firing off at the same time. A connection is inclined or tends to be drawn between them. It's, socially it's kind of like two people are interested in the same things, they always end up going to the same functions. They're both interested in politics, they're both interested in chess. They tend to form a connection or an association between them. Accidental association, things that are beside each other, tend in some circumstances to create connections. And again, you can think of this socially, people who live beside each other tend over time to form a connection between each other. You're more likely to know the people in your town than to know the people in a little town in Africa. Backpropagation is a technical term. It comes from the connectionist literature. Connectionist literature is a type of computer science of what are called neural networks. And what backpropagation is basically trial and error. And so what happens in a backpropagating system, try saying that three times, it's really hard. I've developed, this is my biggest side, a new appreciation for rap and hip-hop. Because I've been listening to some podcasts, rock on, right? No rap, no hip-hop. But I've been listening to some podcasts from Radio 3, and I've been listening, they speak fast. I can't do that. I probably could when I was younger. Anyhow. Backpropagation is trial and error. The idea here is you have some stimulus, it goes into the network. Using the other mechanisms, you create connections between the neurons, and then coming out of the network is some sort of response or behavior or whatever, and then that behavior is in some way corrected. And the effect of that correction is sent back through the network, hence backpropagation, and the original connections are adjusted according to that correction. You can think of it figuratively as you learn about fire, that prompts you to put your hand in the fire, you go, ouch, shouldn't do that, that corrects your perceptions about fire. That's a very broad stroke picture. Boltzmann learning is a way of forming and reforming networks of connections just by settling into a stable state. You might think of this as reflecting. The mechanism is the same as if you drop a stone into a pond, the water will ripple, but eventually it will settle into its most even state. And then what you do in Boltzmann mechanisms is you throw another rock in the pond. And you keep doing that until all the water is at the lowest possible state. I'm describing that by metaphor, obviously, but the idea here is that the connections that form between neurons in your brain, or the connections that form between individuals in society, can be all agitated and roiled up, but eventually they just settle into something that's comfortable and familiar. The same thing happens socially as happens in the brain. You need to stir this up every once in a while in order to reform these connections. Kind of like the way, the tables can be mixed, or kind of like the way if you travel or if you have visitors to your country or your town or whatever, right? Lesson to Steve, don't create metaphors on the fly. So what that results in is a pedagogy that is basically based on these principles of association, basically based on the principles of forming connections both personally and in society, based on the idea of forming connections generally. So I've proposed a learning theory, and it doesn't deserve to be called a learning theory, and it doesn't deserve to be something that I can say I proposed, because it's something that goes back into prehistory and is very simple and very usable. To teach is to model and demonstrate. To learn is to practice and reflect. And essentially what those involved is the participation of a person, whether a teacher or a learner, in a quote-unquote authentic community of practice. The idea here is that you immerse yourself in the community about which you wish to learn. In this model, the role of the teacher isn't to deliver facts, because people won't listen to them anyways. Rather, the role is to practice one's own work in an open and transparent manner. What I'm doing here is I'm recording this. This is me working in an open and transparent manner. The idea here is that somebody once said to me, well, you think by speaking, and that's quite true. I get up, I do these talks. These talks are me not trying to teach. These talks are me trying to learn by re-articulating what it is that I'm thinking about at any given time. And in that re-articulation, I'm doing that re-articulation in an open manner. I'm doing it in front of an audience here. I'm doing it in front of an online audience. And that is the role of a practitioner. If you're a physicist, you would do something different. You would do physics. If you're a doctor, you would do doctoring. Medicine? You know what I mean? To work, part of working is to engage in this community. And, you know, we see this in science, we see this in other disciplines, we see this in things like the guilds and apprenticeship, we see this in the philosophy of Thomas Kuhn, where he talks about normal science being working in this community, where learning normal science is, as Kuhn says, learning how to solve the problems at the end of the chapter. Now, what that means is not accumulating facts, but rather becoming like other people who are in that community, as evidenced by using a vocabulary similarly, having the same sort of standards of evidence, standards of proof, having the same way of looking at the world. To learn in this model is to attach oneself to that authentic environment. To, if you're interested in physics, to actually become in communication with physicists, to watch and see how physicists perform their science, their craft, their art, to observe and to attempt to emulate that. You see that a lot in computer science, where people will study code that has been written by programmers and then attempt to emulate it. The World Wide Web was built that way. The World Wide Web was built by people watching other people create bits of it and then copying it. And then to be reflective about this, to not simply blindly imitate, but to imitate with an idea of reflecting on and correcting one's own performance.
Say, Steve, that first point you made has been challenged by a number of pedagogical people in the sense that they think that maths school curriculum is the least authentic environment one could have on the mathematics. Fragments, that just an example. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, sure, yeah. I like to tell the story of how I learned trigonometry when that sort of thing comes up. Just, I'm an expert in trigonometry. Well, I'm not really, but I should be. I studied trigonometry in high school, and then after I graduated from high school, I took a course in college, computer science. First year computer science was general, so I studied trigonometry again. And then after I left college and I went to university, and when I signed up for university, they considered me a non-matriculated adult. And in particular, I had to take math remediation, math 101. So I studied trigonometry again. I still didn't know it. But one of the things that I liked to do is make Star Trek computer programs. I bought myself a Borland Turbo C, if you can imagine, and just love that. And I would spend like hours and hours and hours creating the ultimate Star Trek game. It was wonderful. You'd be in a ship, and then you'd come toward a planet, and then I had all kinds of systems and functions that would build the planet. It would create rivers, build continents, and then you needed to land on your ship on the planet, and then you'd build a technology, and eventually you'd have your spaceship. And so I wanted other spaceships in the view screen, you know, like on Star Trek. And so there's the spaceship on the view screen, and I want it to rotate, because, you know, it's a three-dimensional object. Well, in order to make your spaceship on your screen rotate, you need to know trigonometry. And that is when I learned trigonometry. And that's how I respond to, you know, that sort of comment, only usually more brief. Sorry. But I think it's a great story.
Stephen, just an observation. You described this in terms of observe, emulate, and improve.
Right.
And that seems to me to be at the heart of the open source movement, where code is freely available. And yet we have a lot of institutions and schools perhaps not trust that movement and prefer to go with proprietary software where the code is closed.
Yeah, and it's too bad, because they're actually robbing themselves of a good learning tool. Mm. You know, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, open source software is, for many people, a learning environment. For many people, for most people in that movement, and the use of open source software very specifically creates possibility for that kind of learning. That's why the One Laptop Per Child project, for example, explicitly adopted open source, and it's the Sugar operating system also that's used on the One Laptop Per Child is open source, because they know that when you take these computers with the open source software and put it in the hand of kids, they will take it apart. And they will learn how it works by taking it apart and seeing how it's done for themselves. And then trying new things. And computer software is wonderful, because you get this instant gratification, right? You try something, it either works or it crashes your computer. But it's the seeing how other people do it and trying to emulate that is so essential. Actually, I have a bunch of slides on that. Melbourne 4, but I'm not going to have a chance to get to them, but I will post those slides when I post this presentation on my website after, so you can see those slides, because they're kind of narrative, so that's why they're at the end, because they're like, I don't want to just be narrating a bunch of slides, but you're absolutely right. And I will say this, because this is important. Learning in this way is very much like having a conversation, but the conversation is not conducted in words. The conversation is conducted in artifacts. In the open source community, the conversation is conducted in computer source. I sometimes tell people I'm trilingual, right? I talk C, I talk Pascal, and I talk Perl. And there's a slide later on, I think it's even in here. If you look at people who are using web technologies today, they are engaged in this conversation with their communities, but they're talking with lolcats. They're talking with little videos. They're talking with slideshare things. This is their vocabulary. These are their words. This is how they see how each other thinks, how each other perceives the world. This is how they form this community and this body of knowledge. And so that's why it's so important that there is open and free access to these materials, because it's not open and free access to a video, it's not open and free access to a cartoon, it's open and free access to the very language of discourse that is being used to create knowledge and learning today. And when you block that, it's like blocking words from people, it's like blocking off, you know, the letters Q through R, Q, M through V, it's better. So here's in diagram form is the model that I've been discussing. So again, teaching is to model, and I'm just going to skip through these. I really want to show you the Connectivist course, and I won't be able to do that if I linger on these slides. To model and to demonstrate, and they're, you know, again, classic examples of how we model and how we demonstrate. Everything from code libraries to image samples to images at work. Chaos Manners, a column that was written by a guy called Jerry Pornell, he would describe his thought processes when he tried to install software or new bits of hardware on his computer. Learning, practice, everyone knows this. I mean, this is not new. You don't need somebody to say, oh, learning is practice. Of course learning is practice. The big fallacy of online learning and computer learning in general is that it's some magical shortcut, and it isn't. It facilitates better practice, and it facilitates better reflection, but it doesn't somehow pop knowledge into your head automatically. Reflection, and you can have guided reflection, you can have structured reflection, you can have reflection in the form of journaling, blogs, wikis, or discussion or sharing. The reflection that we can do here when we have these small groups, the reflection that all of you will do after this session when you talk among yourselves about it. And then drawing a line through these things, you begin with choice, you begin with ownership of the material, personal learning by the individual learner, learning that creates an identity, and you know, I can refer to people like Sherry Turkle, who wrote Life on the Screen about identity formation in MUDs, to Dana Boyd, who wrote Identity in MySpace, to identity even as a technological issue, identity as expressed through OpenID, identity as something that persists from one place to another. All of these things are going to come into play in this model. I'm going to pop out of here, because what personal learning means to learners really is something like this Connectivist course, so of course. Do you see how this is, right? 0, 1, 2, right? Every single time I've gone to open the slideshow, the one number that I need has been the one that's not on there. It just kills me. And it just happened to work out that way. It's just the order that I had them opened before this session. But so really, the way it was supposed to work, just very quickly switch slideshows, and you don't even notice that it's happening. But this is what learning looks like when you think of learning as forming connections rather than acquiring facts. This is what learning looks like when you think of learning as learning networks. This is the structure of the Connectivist course that George Simmons and I offered at the start of the course. Now, by the end of the course, it was really complex. This map was actually drawn for us by one of the participants in the course. George and I didn't do this. They did this. It was kind of like they wanted some sort of reference. And it turns out this was really useful. It's kind of impossible to read from the screen there. But you get an idea of the structure of the course. It basically is a web or a network. So, and the Connectivist course was basically a 12-week course that we offered through the University of Manitoba last fall. And the course was about connectivism, and it was also a Connectivist course. So it was recursive. I do lots of programming. I love recursion, so I really appreciated that. So the idea here is we used the methods of the course in order to teach the concept. And in a certain way, that was really the best way to go. So we had a lot of people in the course. We had 2,200 people sign up for the course. 22 of those people, or 24, something like that, I forget exactly, paid tuition. The rest of the people in the course accessed the course for free. So this was a class. This was not simply distributed learning. It was also very deliberately intended to be open learning, because we come to that point about open source and the vocabulary that people use, and both George and I think that it's very important that learning be open, because learning is a process of acquiring and using the vocabulary. Blocking it off is to actually block off the processes that enable people to learn. So, 12-week course, it was part of an actual certificate, and as I said, it explored the concepts of connectivism and connective knowledge. Connectivism is the thesis that knowledge is distributed across a network of connections, as I've been talking about thus far. So, here's how we set it up. First of all, we used a wiki. The wiki was, as I recall, MediaWiki, and it was installed on the University of Manitoba's computers. We didn't have to use a MediaWiki. We could have gone to WikiSpaces or PBWiki or any of these wikis that are available online, but we used the wiki that we actually installed on our server ourselves. In that wiki, the idea was that over the summer before the course, George and I would put up some thoughts, but basically we would have the people who were taking the course build the structure of the course. And what happened was George and I built the course. It's just one of these things. So we also set it up, as I said, for open enrollment. So we put up the sign-up sheet right on the wiki, and we advertised it in both of our blogs, and that's it. Just he put it in his blog, I put it in my newsletter. That was our advertising. And then people started signing up. In the wiki, the way we set up the course in the wiki is we had 12 weeks. Each week had pretty much the same structure. We had some presentations and papers. The plan was George and I would each do a video or some text or an audio recording or something like that. The actuality is we did some, but we certainly didn't do it every week because that would have killed us. But we did a few. George did an introductory video to start, which we'll see a screenshot from in a little bit. We also linked to readings that were relevant to that week. This is important. The course materials themselves, we didn't assemble a whole bunch of stuff and create a course package. We rather instead found stuff that was out there on the internet and linked to it. This solves all kinds of problems, not the least of which is the whole thing of copyright and permissions and all of that. Because all we're doing is linking to something. You're allowed to do that. You don't even need permission. And the people who are in the course can just go to that material and read it where it's sitting. So they just didn't have to worry about copyright or permissions or anything like that. Now you might ask, well, what happens if somebody removes the stuff? Well, somebody did. Halfway through our course, one of the papers that we linked to, the author took it offline. And so we just linked to something else. Because it's not about the content. Right? The content is just part of the environment, but the environment changes. When we lost the content, we just got new content that was more or less the same. We also set up some regular activities. We set up discussions on Wednesdays and Fridays. And then we suggested activities for the students to do themselves. We also set up a blog. The blog was set up using WordPress. It was, again, the software was installed on the University of Manitoba computers. We could have created a blog on WordPress.com or Blogger.com or whatever.com, but we wanted it on the University of Manitoba servers, mostly because it was already there and we didn't need to really do very much thinking. We used the blog, George and I posted entries on the blog, and we used it to reflect on how we thought the course was going. We didn't use it to teach at all. It was more along the lines of, well, I think the course is going pretty well, etc., or such and such a person is being annoying, and here's what I think of that, or this is taking too much time, you know, those kinds of reflections. What we were doing here with this blog was teaching openly. We were reflecting about our own teaching practice in this connectivist environment that became part of the connectivist learning materials. We also set up a Moodle forum. Moodle, if you're not familiar with it, is an open source learning management system. It's written in PHP, which means it's kind of messy to work with. But again, it's free and open source software. The discussion forums in Moodle are standard threaded discussions. And basically what we did is we set up a new discussion for each week of the course, and we enabled students to set up their own discussions, and some of them did. I wasn't thrilled by the discussions. I found that because, you know, the discussions are sort of, you know, everybody comes to look at the discussion, so everybody's here. 2,200 people, we have a lot of people. But also, too, when you have everybody coming to the same place, people begin to pose. People begin to try to take over the discussion and pursue their own interests or their own agenda, whatever that may be. And we saw instances of that. And so what happened was, after the first, well, there were a couple of things we had to stress over and over to students right from the first week. The first thing was, don't read everything. You can't read everything. There were 2,200 people posting comments in this course. That is not, you are not expected to read all of that. You're not expected to read all of the readings. You're not expected to read all of everything. What you are expected to do is pick and choose from this flow of material stuff that is interesting to you. And that gives you a particular perspective on the material. Think of yourself as one node in this network, and you're connected here, here, and here, but not to everything. And that gives you a unique view. And then it's the combining and the interaction of these views that creates new knowledge and new learning. So we reinforced that over and over. And eventually, by the end of it, simply by the fact that nobody could keep up, people began to accept that. The other thing was, we said, don't rely on the centralized services. Don't rely on Moodle. Don't rely on the wiki. Feel free, and indeed we encourage you to create instances of course elsewhere. And so the Moodle was very full in the first week, but it tailed off nicely as people moved from the centralized Moodle forum to a more distributed environment. And of course, the people who were posing and posturing in the Moodle forum, they went ballistic. And they accused us of sabotaging the course and taking it over, which George and I both thought was very ironic. So our material is distributed, and of course we know that it's going to be distributed right from the start. So we set up a page flight site. Page flights, when we saw Google Reader earlier, right? It's an RSS aggregator. Page flights is the same kind of thing. It's just it displays the material differently. But each box in a page flight site is an RSS feed. And so here's the blog. And here's the Technorati search. Remember I searched for myself on Twitter. I searched for myself on Technorati. We searched for our own course. Of course, what else would we do, right? Because people all over the internet are writing about the course, abbreviated CCK08, so they can become part of the course by writing about it. And then we just aggregate what they've written and put it into the course. So it didn't matter where they were writing. So we had online forums. Every Wednesday we had an Illuminate forum. And because we had 2,200 people in the course, we were able to get some really good guests. Harold Reingold, for example. Valdis Krebs. Various others. And this worked out really well. We had something like a 200-seat Illuminate license. This was really the only overtly commercial thing that we used, was Illuminate. It worked really well. We didn't need to extend the license, although the people at Illuminate who were following this very closely said that, yeah, if you need to, we'll extend it as much as you need to. We'll just see how many people Illuminate can take. But the most we get was about 150 people. Worked brilliantly. So we did that every Wednesday. Then on Fridays, we worked with Dave Cormier and Jeff Lebo of EdTech Talk. We set up a Skype conversation between George and myself and those two. And then Dave and Jeff took our Skype conversation and streamed it live on Ustream. Ustream is a site that allows you to create live streaming video. I could be doing that right now. In fact, if the bandwidth was better in here, I would turn on Ustream. I've got the little video camera here on my computer. I could be broadcasting this talk worldwide using Ustream just from my computer and the in-room internet. I decided not to do that because I didn't want to kill the internet for all of you who are reading your email. But anyhow, we used Ustream. It wasn't as good as we would have liked. Ustream is still bandwidth heavy, and so people had trouble accessing it and viewing the Ustream feeds. So we found ourselves on a few occasions overloading Ustream and going back to Illuminate, even on the Fridays. Twitter, I've mentioned Twitter before. We set up a Twitter tag, CCK08, and then we did Twitter searches so that people could find out what they were saying about the course. So we created this whole Twitter back channel, and then I subscribed to it in my Google Reader so I could keep up. And in fact, I had to make sure that it only updated once a day because it would have overwhelmed me. Twitter is the great take it or leave it kind of, you know, and it's exactly an example of this content as flow, right? Nobody would keep their Twitter posts and store them anywhere. It's like conversation, really conversation. You're either in the conversation or it's done, it's over, start something new. Then we used a piece of software that I've developed. Can I just ask, how am I doing on time? Time?
About 7 or 8 minutes.
Gotcha, good. All right, thank you. I was really afraid I was like going like 12:30 or 1:30. Or I just wanted to make sure I wasn't going way over time. Grasshopper is a piece of software that I created. It's a prototype personal learning environment. Now what Grasshopper does is it instantiates this network approach to learning. You saw this diagram at the beginning of the session today. And what it does basically is it's that center circle there, and Grasshopper is used to connect to all these external resources. The function of the software is to aggregate, remix, repurpose, feed forward. So there's the architecture of it, and it's kind of a nasty little diagram, but the idea here is that it gives you a place to gather content, gather conversation from out there on the internet, work with it, play with it, create something new, and then send it forward. So the idea of Grasshopper, now most of you are familiar with learning management systems, where the software is owned and run by the institution, and the learner goes to the institution. Grasshopper and similar personal learning environment software, there will be other types coming along, count on it, guaranteed, this is coming, is centered around the individual learner. So each learner, each person has their own instance of Grasshopper or any PLE, just as they would have their own instance of a blog or their own instance, you know, their own Twitter account or whatever. It's personal rather than institutional. And so you have your login and all of that. And it's intended to support OpenID. And what that means is you have your own personal Grasshopper site. That Grasshopper site is also your identity. And when you go to other sites, you carry that identity with you so that other sites know who you are. And you have the same identity, the same username, the same login at all the different sites across the internet. And you're going to see, you will see, guaranteed, much more about OpenID and similar systems in the future. Now, what Grasshopper does is it allows me not simply to aggregate content, but also to send it out. Now, one way it allows me to send it out is through newsletter subscriptions. Those of you who subscribe to OL Daily, this is what you used, right? You all would have gone to this page, and you would have signed up, username, password, and you would have picked a newsletter to subscribe to. And that's what we did as well in the connectivism course. In the connectivism course, we had a daily newsletter, and we called it The Daily, because we have no imagination. And so the people in the connectivism course, if they wished, because nothing was required, could sign up for The Daily. And 1,870 people from day one through to the end of the course were consistently signed up. There's a little churn around the margins, but that number of subscribers remained constant. That's how we know. Look, activity in the Moodle forums went nosedived, but we had constant subscribers to The Daily. So we knew that we had constant attendance in the course. Pages auto-archive in the system so that if you start late, you can catch up very easily. And the newsletter is basically just a page from the website that we send through the email. And we can create, as you can see here from my own website, a bunch of different pages. Each one of those could be a newsletter. Pages are supported with a page editing system. And it's kind of hard to see here, but if you look, you see a bunch of squiggles and commands. These pages are generated dynamically from a database. And that's what makes this system work, right? Because what can happen now is we can import content from a wide variety of blogs or other RSS sources. We just toss the content into the database. We rework the content there, and then that database content becomes the content of our newsletter or of our RSS feed. So, Grasshopper harvests these RSS feeds. Just like Google Reader, you saw the Google Reader earlier, it does the same thing, except instead of just displaying it, it tosses the content into a database, as I said. So these are sites that I harvest on my own website, downs.ca, and we also had a set of sites for Grasshopper. We'll come back to that in a sec. So here's the harvester. It just allows me to manage the harvesting of content from external sites. And now here's a page that allows me to manage the harvested content as it comes in. I can categorize it, I can crosswalk it to different data types, I can sort it and organize it as it comes in, and that's in fact what I do. This page, you can't see it because I've scrolled down a little bit, but it's called mapping. So I map my input feeds to various data structures. I can view the harvested content in a viewer, and I can take the harvested content from that viewer and put it into an editor, and now I'm editing content that I've harvested. And it's open source software, so people can see how all this was done. So, if you're curious, there's the URL, grasshopper, without an A, .downs.ca. I'm not selling this or anything. There's no service contracts or nothing, and I don't guarantee that it'll work. Just so you know. So, we used Grasshopper to support the course. So, the first thing we did is, as I said, we had the daily newsletter called The Daily, and we sent that out every day to the 1,870 email subscribers, or people can subscribe to it using RSS, or people could just come to the website. So there's the content administration system for the connectivism course. Now here's the key point. These are the links that were harvested by Grasshopper. These links were created by the students in the course. Remember we said, don't use the discussion list, go somewhere else. And we said, go to your blogs, go to Delicious, go wherever. But wherever you go, tell us where you went. Tell us what the RSS feed is. And so 170 separate students created their own blogs or whatever, and we harvested them all. And then what we did is every day, content that was created by these people on their different blogs was brought together and put in the daily and sent out to everybody else. All automatic. We even made the OPML, outline processor markup language file available so that you did not have to use Grasshopper. They could take this OPML file, upload it into Google Reader, and read it there if they wanted. So anyhow, and I see Jerry over there, which means that it's about 1 o'clock. But the point here is we distributed not just the content, but the participation in the course over a wide variety of websites. And then we used the mechanisms of aggregation and distribution in order to basically create the links between these different things that people were creating. And what we saw, what the result was people became incredibly creative. The students created course maps. They created other course maps. They created videos instructing people on how to add stuff to the course maps. They created Wordles and more Wordles and more Wordles. They passed information about the course from one person to the next to the next. They created Google groups. They created translations. So we had numerous translations of the course. They created, I don't know what this is. I honestly don't know. It's in my slideshow, but I still don't know. They created 3 separate Second Life areas. 2 of them were in Spanish. Digo, delicious, WordPress stuff, and more. And that's what happened. And it blossomed, and it was a proliferation of all kinds of incredible content. And it's interesting because even now, months after the course has ended, they're still producing stuff. And so I think I'll stop the presentation there, because we're out of time. And as always, 3 hours seems like a lot at the start and very little at the end. I do have one hand waving over there, so I'll take that.
In Victoria, learning doesn't count unless we can assess it and report on it. So at least those 24 that were enrolled in a formal course, how did you assess and report on how they went?
Yeah, that's changing, you know. That's the first thing I'll say. The second thing is we actually began to see a new model for assessment begin to emerge because 2,200 people, right, as you say, 22 of those, or 24, whatever, were signed up for the course. But we also had someone contact us and say, we want to take the course, but the assessment will happen in our own home institution. And this was a student in Israel. And that's what the student did. They took the course, did the assignments, handed it in to their people. So that gives us a model where we can have a course like this, a large distributed course around a subject area that's manic and chaotic and all of that. And people can participate in the course, and then they take their participation in the course and they go back to their home institution or their home state or their home corporation or whatever, and they present the work that they've done and say, here's the work I've done in this course for assessment. And so the assessment can be done locally according to local standards and conditions, even though the learning occurred globally. And this can happen because the global instantiation of the learning can be, and we encourage it to be, localized by the people who are taking part in it. So that's the long-winded answer. And then the even more long-winded answer is about assessment by, not by standardized tests, but assessment by portfolio, assessment by peer recognition, so on. But that's all a separate story.
Great stuff to follow up at lunch, though. We do need to wrap up because lunch is coming and it'll incur a charge, etc., if we don't. You know, Stephen really annoys me.
Sorry.
Well, he makes everything that's so complex seem simple. And I wish I could do it. You can if I can't. And that's why Stephen's actually a senior researcher at the National Research Council of Canada, as you all know. He's a great philosopher. He's a great researcher. He reads science fiction all the time. He's a brilliant photographer. Now, that's his greatest skill, by the way. Look at his photographs wherever he's been. So you'll see Melbourne on the Old Daily shortly. He's a complete subversive, and that makes him a good educator. He's a brilliant tinkerer, and he's a great thinker. And you know, what he's done this morning is not tell us about learning, he's actually engaged us in what he's done and how it's actually happened. He did it by doing, which I think is fantastic. Today was all about learning too, or learning in a connected world, and he set us a task to set up our own professional learning space. Mash it up. Ladies and gentlemen, will you join me in thanking Stephen very much? Now, Linda, at the back, will tell us about lunch.
Thank you very much. If I could just ask a couple of things before we move off to lunch, is that just on your table,